Good afternoon, morning, or good evening, and welcome to Channel 85. Nice to have you in our little net. I'm Fred Flam, director of Washed and Unwatched Programming, and co-owner and co-partner with my co-operator, Clark Cable.
Did you know that Republicans are stupid and evil?
Stupid. Coming to you from the great state of Minnesota.
You look great in here, Fred, Chris, green, blue.
Welcome to On the Left, a podcast of news and views from a liberal perspective.
Hello once again and welcome to On the Left podcast. This is episode 24, part 2 of our gay marriage episode. You will kind of all know what we're talking about, so I'm going to get right into it here. I'm going to start with a interview that was released from Democracy Now! On Thursday. This is Juan Gonzalez and Amy Goodman talking to Sharon Minster. She's the director, a legal director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Mark Solomon, who is the director of Equality in California. So let's get right to it and get to the interview from Democracy Now!
We begin today's show in California, where a federal judge struck down Proposition 8, the state's voter-approved ban on the same-sex marriages. The ruling by U.S. District Court Chief Judge Vaughn Walker is being hailed as a major victory for gay rights advocates. In his ruling, Judge Walker wrote, quote, Proposition 8 fails to advance any rational basis in singling out gay men and lesbians for denial of a marriage license. The evidence shows Proposition 8 does nothing more than enshrine in the California Constitution the notion that opposite-sex couples are superior to same-sex couples. Walker is the first federal judge to strike down a marriage ban on federal constitutional grounds. The case is almost certain to reach the U.S. Supreme Court. It is unclear if gay and lesbian couples will be able to marry in California while the case goes through the appeals process. On Wednesday, Judge Walker issued a temporary stay until he decides whether to suspend his ruling while it is being appealed. The case against Proposition 8 was argued by two longtime adversaries, David Boies and former Solicitor General Ted Olson. 10 years ago, they battled against each other in the Supreme Court case Bush v. Gore. On Wednesday, they celebrated the judge's ruling. This is Ted Olson.
This is a victory for the American people. It's a victory for our justice system. When our individual rights are taken away, when the majority decides that an unpopular group of individuals should be treated differently, and they can't succeed at the ballot box because they are unpopular, because they are a minority, because they are viewed differently by a number of people in the populace, they turn to the courts of the United States, and we have a spectacular constitution that values equality and values fundamental rights and values an independent judiciary to protect and vindicate those rights.
Supporters of gay rights rallied Wednesday in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other cities. Carol Russell celebrated outside the federal courthouse in San Francisco with her wife.
We've been together 41 years. We were married here in San Francisco 2 years ago. Our first date, believe it or not, was the night of Stonewall, and we were on Christopher Street in New York when the Stonewall riot happened. It did not deter us, and we've had a very happy life together, and we want to make sure that the next generation has a happy life, too. We've worked very hard for this. And frankly, it's wonderful to see that in America the system works. And we look forward to the rest of this fight, I guess.
In West Hollywood, Art Andrade celebrated the news with his partner.
My partner and myself have been now together for 18 years, and we've just gotten married a year ago in our window, and we want to see other young gay couples, or other couples, period, older, younger, to take the challenge and to commit themselves to a long and loving relationship.
To talk more about the Prop 8 ruling, we're joined by two guests. Shannon Minter is legal director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights based in San Francisco. He was a lead counsel in the 2008 California State Supreme Court case that allowed same-sex couples to marry, a ruling that was reversed when voters approved Prop 8. And Mark Solomon, he's with us from Los Angeles, marriage director at Equality California. He's been leading the organization's statewide effort to restore the right to marry for gay and lesbian couples. Mark, let's begin with you, your response.
It's a tremendous day. The ruling was just fantastic, and it really said what we believe, which is that committed same-sex couples who are committed to one another for life, are are guaranteed the right to be treated equally under our federal constitution, and it's just fantastic to see a federal judge rule that way. It's something that we all believe, but this is a huge step forward, no question about it.
And Shannon Minter, you were in the courtroom during most of the proceedings. Could you talk about the breadth, I think, of the judge's ruling on this issue?
Yes, you know, it really was remarkable. I just want to say it's so wonderful to hear all the personal reactions. This decision was just so meaningful to so many people and couples in California who've been through such turmoil. And it really just means the world to people to have a federal judge stand up for their equality and dignity and their right to have the same freedom as other people to enter into marriage if they choose. But yes, in terms of the trial itself, it was really a tour de force. There has never been a full-blown evidentiary trial on whether or not same-sex couples have a protected constitutional right to marry. And the plaintiff side with Ted Olson and David Boies put on a really magnificent array of expert witnesses addressing in great depth, you know, the real personal, social, psychological harm caused to same-sex couples by not being able to have the status of marriage and really by being singled out and stigmatized as inferior and unequal. And the decision, Judge Walker's decision yesterday, he literally made 80 separate findings of fact based on all of the testimony that had been presented to him. And many of those findings centered on the very serious harms caused by Proposition 8.
Can you talk about the significance of Judge Walker striking down the marriage ban on federal constitutional grounds, Shannon?
Yes, it's a very big deal. This is the first time that any federal court has held that a law barring same-sex couples from marriage violates federal constitutional protections. It was really a grand slam on that level. Judge Walker ruled in favor of the plaintiffs on all of their federal claims. So finding that same-sex couples have a fundamental right to marry, the same right that others have under the federal constitution, and that Proposition 8 violates the federal equal protection clause because Judge Walker found it discriminates both on the basis of gender and on the basis of sexual orientation. So these are core constitutional issues, and having those issues being litigated in the federal court system means, as you alluded to at the beginning of the segment, that it's quite likely that the U.S. Supreme Court will end up opining on whether Judge Walker was correct in his construction of the Constitution.
Well, he specifically also seemed to refer to attempts to have the voters decide this issue. And at one point in his decision, he said, conjecture, speculation, and fears are not enough. Still less will the moral disapprobation of a group or class of citizens suffice, no matter how large the majority that shares that view. So he was seemingly saying, hey, this is a constitutional issue, and no matter what the people feel at any particular time in a jurisdiction, there are constitutional rights at stake here.
You know, absolutely. Yeah, this case gets down to really the
right.
Core principle.
And, you know,
Mark Solomon.
We strongly believe that it's wrong for the majority to decide the fundamental rights of a minority group, and that's been our position all along. And we're obviously very gratified that Judge Walker ruled that way.
I wanted to get response to Newt Gingrich's reaction to the ruling. He said, Judge Walker's ruling overturning Prop 8 is an outrageous disrespect for our Constitution and for the majority of people in the United States who believe marriage is the union of husband and wife. Congress now has the responsibility to act immediately to reaffirm marriage as a union of one man and one woman as our national policy. Newt Gingrich went on to say, today's notorious decision also underscores the importance of the Senate vote tomorrow on the nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court, because judges who oppose the American people are a growing threat to our society. Mark Solomon.
Oh, what an ugly statement. Judges who oppose the American people. That's, you know, I think our Constitution has been about, you know, is a living, breathing document. And it's been about expanding rights for people who, you know, who are oppressed. And I think there's this amazing dynamic as LGBT people tell their stories and talk about who we are. You know, that's what enables judges to see that, you know what, LGBT people are deserving of equal protection. Our relationships are valid, are significant, are important. I mean, I'm not surprised by what Newt Gingrich is saying. It's pretty harsh, though, the idea that a judge, you know, is sort of questioning the patriotism of a judge. But, you know, that's sort of par for the course, I guess, right?
We're going to break and then come back. I wanted to ask about the witnesses that Prop 8 advocates put forward in the court, and also get your personal stories. We're talking to Mark Solomon, marriage director at Equality California, and Shannon Minter, legal director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you, Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez, for another great interview that I clipped out of your show. So we're going to the next part is on the me reading from the document once again, from the ruling. This is going to be on the finding of facts, the law findings, the due process, the conclusions, and then all the way down to the judge's remedies. And then at the very end, there's a little bit of a me with a rant. Now let's get right into the finding of fact. Having considered the evidence presented at trial, the credibility of the witness and the legal arguments presented by counsel, the court now makes the following findings of fact pursuant to FRCP. The court relies primarily on the testimony and exhibits cited herein, although uncited cumulative documentary evidence in the record and considered by the court also support the finding. Now about the first 18 or 19 of the findings of fact are just about the plaintiffs and the proponents and what their standing is for the whole thing. Until we get to fact 19, it looks like, we'll start there. Whether any evidence supports California's refusal to recognize marriage between two people because of their sex. Fact 19 states, marriage in the United States has always been a civil matter. Civil authorities may permit religious leaders to solemnize marriage, but not to determine who may enter or leave a civil marriage. Religious leaders may determine independently whether to recognize a civil marriage or divorce, but that recognition or lack thereof has no effect on the relationship under state law. Fact 20. A person may not marry unless he or she has the legal capacity to consent to marriage. Fact 21. California, like every other state, has never required that individuals entering a marriage be willing or able to procreate. Fact 22. When California became a state in 1850, marriage was understood to require a husband and a wife. Fact 24. Many states, including California, had laws restricting the race of marital partners so that whites and non-whites could not marry each other. Fact 25. Racial restrictions on an individual's choice of marriage partner were deemed unconstitutional under the California Constitution in 1948 and under the United States Constitution in 1967. An individual's exercise of his or her right to marry no longer depends on his or her race, nor on the race of his or her chosen partner. Number 26. Under coverture, I know I'm saying that wrong, a woman's legal and economic identity was usurped by her husband's upon marriage. The husband was the legal head of household. This is no longer part of the marital bargain. Number 27. Marriage between a man and a woman was traditionally organized based on presumptions of the division of labor among gender lines. Men were seen as suitable for certain types of work, and women for others. Women were seen as suitable to raise children, and men were seen as suited to provide for the family. Well, that's a nice 50s, 60s thought there. Number 28, the development of no-fault divorce laws may be simpler for spouses to end marriages and allow spouses to define their own roles within marriage. Number 29, in 1971, California amended the California Civil Code, which had previously set the age of consent to marriage at 21 years for males and 18 years for females, to read any unmarried person of the age of 18 years or upward and not otherwise disqualified is capable of consenting to a marriage. Now that, in my sense right there, would say that back in the 1970s, they said it was okay for gays to get married. It's worded, any unmarried person of the age of 18 years. Doesn't specify gender now, does it? I'm going to skip a couple. Now we're going to go up to number 32. California has eliminated marital obligation based on gender of the spouse. Regardless of their sex or gender, marital partners share the same obligation to one another and to their dependents. As a result of Proposition 8, California nonetheless requires that a marriage consist of one man and one woman. Number 33, eliminating gender and race restrictions in marriage has not deprived the institute of marriage of its validity. Number 34, marriage is the state recognition and approval of a couple's choice to live with each other, to remain committed to one another, and to form a household based on their own feelings about one another, to join in an economic partnership and support one another and any dependents. That sounds just like a marriage to me. Number 35, the state has many purposes in licensing and fostering marriage. Some of the state's purposes benefit the persons married, while some benefit the state. Finding 36, states and the federal government channel benefits, rights, and responsibilities through marital status. Marital status affects immigration and citizenship, tax policy, property and inheritance rules, and social benefit programs. Number 37, marriage creates economic support obligations between consenting adults and for their dependents. Number 38, marriage benefits both spouses by promoting physical and psychological health. Married individuals are less likely to engage in behaviors detrimental to health, like smoking or drinking heavily. Married individuals live longer on average than unmarried individuals. I'm not sure about that smoking and drinking part. I know a lot of married people that do a lot of smoking and drinking. But I digress. Let's go on to number 39. Material benefits, legal protections, and social support resulting from marriage can increase wealth and improve psychological well-being for married spouses. Number 40. The long-term nature of marriage allows spouses to specialize their labor and encourages spouses to increase household efficiency by dividing labor in increased productivity. Number 42, same-sex love and intimacy are well documented in human history. The concept of an identity based on object desire, that is, whether an individual desires a relationship with someone of the opposite sex, heterosexual, same-sex, homosexual, or either sex, bisexual, developed in the late 19th century. Didn't know that. Number 43, sexual orientation refers to an enduring pattern of sexual or romantic desires for an attraction to men, women, or both sexes. An individual's sexual orientation can be expressed through self-identification, behavior, or attraction. The vast majority of people are consistent in self-identification, behavior, and attention throughout their adult lives. Number 44, sexual orientation is commonly discussed as a characteristic of an individual. Sexual orientation is fundamental to a person's identity and is a distinguishing characteristic that defines gays and lesbians as a discrete group. Proponents' assertion that sexual orientation cannot be defined as contrary to the weight of the evidence. Number 45. Proponents' campaign for Proposition 8 assumed voters understood the existence of homosexuals as individuals distinct from heterosexuals. Okay. Number 46, individuals do not generally choose their sexual orientation. No credible evidence supports a finding that an individual may, through conscious decision, therapeutic intervention, or any other method, change his or her sexual orientation. You cannot pray away the gay. Number 47, California has no interest in asking gays and lesbians to change their sexual orientation or in reducing the number of gays and lesbians in California. Number 48, same-sex couples are identical to opposite-sex couples in the characteristics relevant to the ability to form successful marital unions. Like opposite-sex couples, same-sex couples have happy, satisfying relationships and form deep emotional bonds and strong commitments to their partners. Standardized measures of relationship satisfaction, relationship adjustment, and love do not differ depending on whether a couple is same-sex or opposite-sex. I told you this was in-depth. Number 49, California law permits and encourages gays and lesbians to become parents through adoption, foster parenting, and assistive reproductive technology. Approximately 18% of same-sex couples in California are raising children. Number 50, same-sex couples receive the same tangible and intangible benefits from marriage that opposite-sex couples receive. That's just common sense. Number 51, marrying a person of the opposite sex is an unrealistic option for a gay or lesbian individual. I would agree with that. Number 52, domestic partnerships lack the social meaning associated with marriage, and marriage is widely regarded as the definitive expression of love and commitment in the United States. Number 53, domestic partners are not married under California law. California domestic partnerships may not be recognized in other states and are not recognized by the federal government. Understandable. Number 54, the availability of domestic partnerships does not provide gays and lesbians with a status equivalent to marriage because the cultural meaning of marriage and its associated benefits are intentionally withheld from same-sex couples in domestic partnerships. They are not separate but equal. Number 55, permitting same-sex couples to marry will not affect the number of opposite-sex couples who marry, divorce, cohabitate, have children outside of marriage, or otherwise affect the stability of opposite-sex marriage. Number 56, the children of same-sex couples benefit when their parents can marry. Number 58, Proposition 8 places the force of law behind stigmas against gay and lesbians, including gays and lesbians do not have intimate relationships similar to heterosexual couples, gays and lesbians are not as good as heterosexuals, and gays and lesbian relationships do not deserve the full recognition of society. 59. Proposition 8 requires California to treat same-sex couples differently from opposite-sex couples. 60. Proposition 8 reserves the most socially valued form of relationship, marriage, for opposite-sex couples. 61. Proposition 8 amends the California Constitution to codify distinct and unique roles for men and women in marriage. Number 62. Proposition 8 does not affect the First Amendment rights of those opposed to marriage for same-sex couples. Prior to Proposition 8, no religious group was required to recognize marriage for same-sex couples. 63. Proposition 8 eliminates the right to marry for gays and lesbians, but does not affect any other substantive right under the California Constitution. Number 64. Proposition 8 has had a negative fiscal impact on California and local governments. Number 66. Proposition 8 increases cost and decreases wealth for same-sex couples because of an increased tax burdens, decreased availability of health insurance, and higher transaction costs to secure rights and obligations traditionally associated with marriage. Domestic partnerships reduces but does not eliminate these costs. Number 67. Proposition 8 singles out gay and lesbians and legitimates their unequal treatment. Proposition 8 perpetuates the stereotype that gays and lesbians are incapable of forming long-term, loving relationships, and that gays and lesbians are not good parents. Number 69. The factors that affect whether a child is well-adjusted are, 1. The quality of the child's relationship with his or her parents, 2. The quality of the relationship between the child's parents or significant adult in the child's life, and 3. The availability of economic and social resources. Number 70. The gender of the child's parent is not a factor in the child's adjustment. The sexual orientation of an individual does not determine whether the individual can be a good parent. Children raised by gay and lesbian parents are as likely as children raised by heterosexual parents to be healthy, successful, and well-adjusted. The research supporting this conclusion is accepted beyond serious debate in the field of development psychology. Children do not need to be raised by a male parent and a female parent to be well-adjusted, and having both a male and female parent does not increase the likelihood that a child will be well-adjusted. Number 72. The genetic relationship between a parent and a child is not related to the child's adjustment outcome. Number 73. Studies comparing outcomes for children raised by married opposite-sex parents to children raised by single or divorced parents do not inform conclusions about outcome for children raised by same-sex parents in stable long-term relationships. Number 74. Gays and lesbians have been victims of a long history of discrimination. Number 75. Public and private discrimination against gays and lesbians occurs in California and in the United States. Who would have thought? Number 76. Well-known stereotypes about gay men and lesbians include a belief that gays and lesbians are affluent, self-absorbed, and incapable of forming long-term intimate relationships. Other stereotypes imagine gay men and lesbians as disease vectors or as child molesters who recruit young children into homosexuality. No evidence supports these stereotypes. We're getting close to the end here. Just a couple more to go. Number 77. Religious beliefs that gay and lesbian relationships are sinful or inferior to heterosexual relationships harms gays and lesbians, and in my opinion, they harm society. That was just my little end at the bit on the end. Number 78, stereotypes and misinformations have resulted in social and legal disadvantages for gays and lesbians. 79, the Proposition 8 campaign relied on fears that children exposed to the concept of same-sex marriage may become gay or lesbian. The reason children need to be protected from same-sex marriage was never articulated in official campaign advertisements. Nonetheless, the advertisements insinuated that learning about same-sex marriage would make a child gay or lesbian, and that parents should dread having a gay or lesbian child. Number 80, and this is the last one. The campaign to pass Proposition 8 relied on stereotypes to show that same-sex relationships are inferior to opposite-sex relationships. Now, underneath each one of these findings of fact, there is a list of examples and information on how and what in the transcript from the court case he used to make that finding of fact. I wasn't going to read all of those because we just went through about 90 pages worth of stuff. So you can go and read the particulars yourself. Now, why did I subject you to all of that? Well, I wanted you to show you that how in-depth and detailed this particular judge was with this ruling. Now we're going to go into the last bit here, last two bits. This is the conclusion of law. The plaintiffs challenge Proposition 8 under the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses of the 14th Amendment. Each challenge is independently meritorious, as Proposition 8 both unconstitutionally burdens the exercise of the fundamental right to marry and creates an irrational classification on the basis of sexual orientation. Now, due process. The Due Process Clause provides that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Due process protects individuals against arbitrary governmental intrusion into life, liberty, or property, when legislation burdens the exercise of a right deemed to be fundamental, the government must show that the intrusion withstands strict scrutiny. The freedom to marry is recognized as a fundamental right protected by the Due Process Clause. The parties do not dispute that the right to marry is fundamental. The question presented here is whether plaintiffs seek to exercise a fundamental right to marry, or because that the couples are of the same sex, whether they seek recognition of a new right. To determine whether the right is fundamental under the Due Process Clause, the court inquires into whether the right is rooted in our nation's history, legal traditions, and practices. Here, because the right to marry is fundamental, the court looks to the evidence presented at trial to determine, 1, the history, tradition, and practices of marriage in the United States, 2, whether plaintiffs seek to exercise their right to marry or seek to exercise some other right. Marriage has retained certain characteristics throughout the history of the United States. Marriage requires two parties to give their free consent to form a relationship, which then forms the foundation of a household. The spouses must consent to support each other and any dependents. The state regulates marriage because marriage creates stable households, which in turn form the basis of a stable, governable populace. The state respects an individual's choice to build a family with another and protects the relationship because it is so central to the part of the individual's life. Never has the state inquired into procreative capability or intent before issuing a marriage license. Indeed, a marriage license is more than a license to have procreative sexual intercourse. It would demean a marriage couple if it were said marriage is simply about the right to have sexual intercourse. The Supreme Court recognizes that wholly apart from procreation, choice and privacy play a pivotal role in a marital relationship. Race restrictions on marital partners were once common in most states, but are now seen as archaic, shameful, and even bizarre. When the Supreme Court invalidated race restrictions in Loving, the definition of the right to marry did not change. Instead, the court recognized that race restrictions, despite their historical prevalence, stood in stark contrast to the concepts of liberty and choice inherent in the right to marry. The marital bargain in California, along with other states, traditionally required that a woman's legal and economic identity be subsumed by her husband's upon marriage under the doctrine of coverture. This once unquestionable aspect of marriage now is regarded as antithetical to the notion of marriage as a union of equals. As states moved to recognize the equality of the sexes, they eliminated the laws and practices that had made gender a proxy for a spouse's role within marriage. Marriage has thus transformed from a male-dominated institution into an institution recognizing men and women as equals. Yet individuals retained the right to marry. That right did not become different simply because the institution of marriage became compatible with gender equality. The evidence at trial shows that marriage in the United States traditionally has not been open to same-sex couples. The evidence suggests many reasons for this tradition of exclusion, including gender roles mandated through coverture, social disapproval of same-sex relations, and the reality that a vast majority of people are heterosexual and have had no reason to challenge the restriction. The evidence shows that the movement of marriage away from a gendered institution and toward an institution free from state-mandated gender roles reflects an evolution in the understanding of gender rather than a change in marriage. The evidence did not show any historical purpose for excluding same-sex couples from marriage, as states have never required spouses to have an ability or willingness to procreate in order to marry. Rather, the exclusion exists as an artifact of a time when the genders were seen as having distinct roles in society and in marriage. That time has passed. The right to marry has been historically and remains the right to choose a spouse and, with mutual consent, join together and form a household. Race and gender restrictions shaped marriage during eras of race and gender inequality. But such restrictions were never part of the historical core of the institution of marriage. today, gender is not relevant in the state in determining spouses' obligations to each other and to their dependents. Relative gender composition aside, same-sex couples are situated identically as opposite-sex couples in terms of their ability to perform the right and obligations of marriage under California law. Gender no longer forms an essential part of marriage. Marriage under law is a union of equals. Plaintiffs do not seek recognition of a new right. To characterize plaintiffs' objectives as the right to same-sex marriage would suggest that plaintiffs seek something different from what opposite-sex couples across the state enjoy, namely, marriage. Rather, plaintiffs ask California to recognize their relationships for what they are, marriage. Having determined that plaintiffs seek to exercise their fundamental right to marry under the Due Process Clause, the court must consider whether the availability of registered domestic partnerships fulfill California's due process obligation to same-sex couples. The evidence shows that domestic partnerships were created as an alternative to marriage that distinguished same-sex from opposite-sex couples. California has created two separate and parallel institutions to provide couples with essentially the same rights and obligations. Domestic partnerships are not open to opposite-sex couples unless one party is at least 62 years old. Apart from this limited exception, created expressly to benefit those eligible for benefits under the Social Security Act, the sole basis upon which California determines whether a couple receives the designation married or the designation domestic partnership is the sex of the spouses related to one another. The evidence shows that domestic partnerships do not fulfill California's due process obligation to plaintiffs for two reasons. First, domestic partnerships are distinct from marriage and do not provide the same social meaning as marriage. Second, domestic partnerships were created specifically so that California could offer same-sex couples rights and benefits while explicitly withholding marriage from same-sex couples. The evidence at trial shows that domestic partnerships exist solely to differentiate same-sex unions from marriage. A domestic partnership is not a marriage. While domestic partnerships offer same-sex couples almost all the rights and responsibilities associated with marriage, the evidence shows that the withholding of the designation marriage significantly disadvantages the plaintiffs. The record reflects that marriage is a culturally superior status compared to the domestic partnership. California does not meet its due process obligation to allow plaintiffs to marry by offering them a substitute and inferior institution that denies marriage to same-sex couples. Because plaintiffs seek to exercise their fundamental right to marry, their claim is subject to strict scrutiny. That the majority of California voters supported Proposition 8 is irrelevant, as fundamental rights may not be submitted to a vote. They depend on the outcome of no election. Under strict scrutiny, the state bears the burden of producing evidence to show that Proposition 8 is narrowly tailored to a compelling government interest. Because the government defendants declined to advance such arguments, proponents seized the role of asserting the existence of a compelling California interest in Proposition 8. As explained in detail in the Equal Protection Analysis, Proposition 8 cannot withstand rational basis review. Still less can Proposition 8 survive the strict scrutiny required by plaintiffs' due process claim. The minimal evidence presentation made by proponents does not meet the heavy burden of producing necessary to show that Proposition 8 is narrowly tailored to a compelling government interest. Proposition 8 cannot, therefore, withstand strict scrutiny. Moreover, proponents do not assert that the availability of domestic partnerships satisfies plaintiffs' fundamental right to marry. Proponents stipulate that there is a significant symbolic disparity between domestic partnership and marriage. Accordingly, Proposition 8 violates the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment provides that no state shall deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Equal protection is a pledge of the protection of equal laws. The court defers to legislative, or in this case, popular judgment if there is at least a debatable question whether the underlying basis for the classification is rational. Even on the most deferential standard of review, however, the court must insist on knowing the relation between the classification adapted and the object to be attained. The court may look to evidence to determine whether the basis for the underlying debate is rational. The search for a rational relationship, while quite deferential, ensures that classifications are not drawn for the purpose of disadvantaging a group burdened by the law. The classification itself must be related to the purported interest. Most laws subject to rational basis easily survive equal protection review. Because of legitimate reasons can nearly always be found for treating different groups in an unequal manner. Yet, to survive rational basis review, a law must do more than disadvantage or otherwise harm a particular group. Now we get into the standard of review. As presently explained in detail, the Equal Protection Clause renders Proposition 8 unconstitutional under any standard of review. Accordingly, the court did not address the question whether laws classifying on the basis of sexual orientation should be subject to a heightened standard of review. Although Proposition 8 fails to possess even a rational basis, the evidence presented at trial shows that gays and lesbians are the type of minority strict scrutiny was designed to protect. The court asked the parties to identify a difference between heterosexuals and homosexuals that the government might fairly need to take into account when crafting legislation. Proponents pointed only to the difference between same-sex couples who are incapable through sexual intercourse of producing offspring biologically related to both parties, and opposite-sex couples, some of whom are capable through sexual intercourse of producing such offspring. Proponents did not, however, advance any reason why the government may use sexual orientation as a proxy for fertilization, or why the government may need to take into account fertility when legislating. The trial record shows that strict scrutiny is the appropriate standard to review to apply to legislative classifications based on sexual orientation. All classifications based on sexual orientation appear suspect, as the evidence shows that California would rarely, if ever, have a reason to categorize individuals based on their sexual orientation. Here, however, strict scrutiny is unnecessary. Proposition 8 fails to survive any rational basis review. Proposition 8 cannot withstand any level of scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause, as excluded same-sex couples from marrying is simply not rationally related to the legitimate state interest. One example of a legitimate state interest in not issuing marriage licenses to a particular group might be a scarcity of marriage license or county officials to issue them. But marriage licenses in California are not a limited commodity, and the experience of 18,000 same-sex married couples in California shows that the state has the resources to allow both same-sex and opposite-sex couples to wed. Proponents put forth several rationales for Proposition 8, which the court now examines in turn. 1. Reserving marriage as a union between a man and a woman, excluding any other relationship from marriage. Proceeding with caution when implementing social changes. 3. Promoting opposite-sex parenting over same-sex parenting. Protecting the freedom of those who oppose marriage for same-sex couples, treating same-sex couples differently from opposite-sex couples, and 6. Any other conceivable interest. I like that one. That's an interesting one there at the end. Proponents first argue that Proposition 8 is rational because it preserves, 1. The traditional institution of marriage as the union of a man and a woman, 2. The traditional social and legal purpose, functions, and structure of marriage, and 3. The traditional meaning of marriage as it has always been defined in the English language. These interests relate to maintaining the definition of marriage as a union of a man and a woman for its own sake. Tradition alone, however, cannot form a rational basis for law. The evidence shows that tradition of restricting an individual's choice of spouse based on gender does not rationally further a state interest despite its ancient lineage. Instead, the evidence shows that the tradition of gender restrictions arose when spouses were legally required to adhere to specific gender roles. The tradition of restricting marriage to opposite-sex couples does not further any state interest. Rather, the evidence shows that Proposition 8 harms the state's interest in equality because it mandates that men and women be treated differently based on antiquated and discredited notions of gender. Proponents argue that tradition prefers same opposite-sex couples to same-sex couples equates to the notion that opposite-sex relationships are simply better than same-sex relationships. Tradition alone cannot legitimate this proposed interest. Evidence shows that the state advances nothing when it adheres to the tradition of excluding same-sex couples from marriage. Proponents' asserted state interests in tradition are nothing more than travesties and do not amount to rational basis for Proposition 8. Proponents next argue that Proposition 8 is related to the state's interest in acting incrementally and with caution when considering a rational transformation to the fundamental nature of a bedrock social institution, decreasing the probability of weakening the institution of marriage, decreasing the probability of adverse consequences that could result from weakening the institution of marriage, and decreasing the probability of the potential adverse consequences of same-sex marriage. Plaintiffs presented evidence at trial significant to rebut any claim that marriage for same-sex couples amounts to a sweeping social change. Instead, the evidence shows beyond debate that allowing same-sex couples to marry has at least a neutral, if not positive, effect on the institution of marriage, and that same-sex couples' marriages would benefit the state. Moreover, the evidence shows that the right of those opposed to homosexuality or same-sex couples will remain unaffected if the state ceases to enforce Proposition 8. Proponents' largest group of purported state interests relate to opposite-sex parents. Proponents argue Proposition 8 promotes stability and responsibility in naturally procreative relationships, promotes enduring and stable family structures for the responsible raising and care of children by their biological parents, increases the probability that natural procreation will occur within stable, enduring, and supporting family structures, and promotes the natural and mutually beneficial bond between parents and their biological children, increases the probability that children will be raised by both of his or her biological parents, increases the probability that each child will have a legally recognized father and mother. The evidence supports two points which together show Proposition 8 does not advance any of the identified interests. Same-sex parents and opposite-sex parents are of equal quality, and Proposition 8 does not make it any more likely that opposite-sex couples will marry and raise offspring biologically related to both parents. Moreover, Proposition 8 has nothing to do with children, as Proposition 8 simply prevents same-sex couples from marrying. Proponents next argue that Proposition 8 protects the First Amendment freedom of those who disagree with allowing marriage for couples of the same sex. Proponents argue that Proposition 8, 1, preserves the procreative and responsibility of parents to provide for the ethical and moral development and education of their own children, and two, accommodates the First Amendment right of individuals and institutions to oppose same-sex marriage on religious and moral grounds. These purported interests fail as a matter of law. Proposition 8 does not affect any First Amendment right or responsibility of parents to educate their children. Californians are prevented from distinguishing between same-sex partners and opposite-sex spouses in public accommodations, as California anti-discrimination laws require identical treatment for same-sex unions and opposite-sex marriage. The evidence shows that Proposition 8 does nothing other than eliminate the right of same-sex couples to marry in California. Proposition 8 is not rationally related to an interest in protecting the rights of those opposed to same-sex couples because, as a matter of law, Proposition 8 does not affect the rights of those opposed to homosexuality or to marriage for couples of the same sex. Proponents argue that Proposition 8 advances a state interest in treating same-sex couples differently from opposite-sex couples by, one, using different names for different things. 2, maintaining the flexibility to separately address the needs of different types of relationships. 3, ensuring that California marriages are recognized in other jurisdictions. And 4, conforming California's definition of marriage to federal law. Here, proponents presume a premise that the evidence thoroughly rebutted. Rather than being different, same-sex and opposite-sex unions are, for all purposes relevant to California law, exactly the same. The evidence shows conclusively that moral and religious views form the only basis for a belief that same-sex couples are different from opposite-sex couples. The evidence fatally undermines any proposed state interest in treating couples differently. Thus, these interests do not provide a rational basis supporting Proposition 8. Finally, proponents assert that Proposition 8 advances any other conceivable legitimate interests identified by the parties or the court in any stage of the proceedings. But proponents, Amik and the court, despite ample opportunity of a full trial, have failed to identify any rational basis Proposition 8 could conceivably advance. Proponents represented by able and energetic counsel developed a full trial record in support of Proposition 8. The resulting evidence shows that Proposition 8 simply conflicts with the guarantees of the Fourth Amendment. In the absence of a rational basis, what remains of proponents' case is an inference applied supported by evidence in the record that Proposition 8 was premised on the belief that same-sex couples simply are not as good as opposite-sex couples. Whether that belief is based on moral disapproval of homosexuality, animosity toward gays and lesbians, or simply a belief that a relationship between a man and a woman is inherently better than a relationship between two men or two women, this belief is not a proper basis on which to legislate. Proponents' purported rationales are nothing more than post hoc justifications. While the Equal Protection Clause does not prohibit post hoc rationalizations, they must connect to the classifications drawn. Here, the purported state interests fit so poorly with Proposition 8 that they are irrational, as explained above. What is left is evidence that Proposition 8 enacts a moral view that there is something wrong with same-sex couples. Unbelievable, a statement like that. Now we're going to come up to the very end. We're going to read the conclusion. Proposition 8 fails to advance any rational basis in singling out gay men and lesbians for denial of a marriage license. Indeed, the evidence shows Proposition 8 does nothing more than enshrine in the California Constitution the notion that opposite-sex couples are superior to same-sex couples. Because California has no interest in discriminating against gay men and lesbians, and because Proposition 8 prevents California from fulfilling its constitutional obligation to provide marriage on an equal basis, the court concludes that Proposition 8 is unconstitutional. It couldn't be clearer what he just said. Unbelievable. Now, the last thing in the paper is the remedies. And this is what Judge Von Walker has written in. Plaintiffs have demonstrated by overwhelming evidence that Proposition 8 violates their due process and equal protection rights, and that they will continue to suffer these constitutional violations until state officials cease enforcement of Proposition 8. California is able to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, as it has already issued 18,000 marriage licenses to same-sex couples and has not suffered any demonstrated harm as a result. Moreover, California officials have chosen not to defend Proposition 8 in these proceedings. Because Proposition 8 is unconstitutional under both the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses, the court orders entry of judgment permanently enjoining its enforcement, prohibiting the officials, defendants, from applying or enforcing Proposition 8, and directing the official defendants that all persons under their control or supervision shall not apply or enforce Proposition 8. The clerk is directed to enter judgment without bond in favor of plaintiffs and plaintiffs' interventors, and against defendants and defendants' interventors, pursuant to the law. It is so ordered. Now, the whole thing that comes out of this is the one thing that I started off believing to begin with. It's the one thing I've known pretty much my whole life. I've known a lot of gay and lesbian people in my life. A lot of them are my friends. There is absolutely no rational base to deny them the right to marry. The only basis that you can come up with is religious bigotry, because their sky god in his book tells them that gay people are bad. That is unacceptable for our laws of this country. I do not care what your sky god says about anything. I believe in our Constitution. Our Constitution says we cannot discriminate against people. There is no reason why gays and lesbians should not be allowed to marry. It's just that simple. This particular ruling by Von Walker is a perfect example of what is right in this country with our judiciary. Here is a gentleman that was put forward for the bench by Ronald Reagan. His nomination was held up by the Democrats at the time. When George H.W. Bush came into office, he once again put Von Walker up in front of a Democratic Congress. They once again refused to nominate him. George H.W. Bush again, a second time in his one term, put up Von Walker again, and he finally got through. Now, I'm waiting for, the right wing has already started attacking him, saying, well, he's openly gay, so he shouldn't be able to rule on this. Well, if an openly gay justice can't rule on discrimination issues, that means a Catholic judge can't rule on anything that the Vatican holds a ruling on, or a Jewish person can't have anything to do with any rules that come out of the Torah. So we would be eliminating pretty much every justice that we have, unless they're atheists. Atheists can rule on all these things, and I don't think the right wing really wants all the atheist judges out there to start ruling on stuff. Now, this has been another very long episode. I hope you have enjoyed the show. I will post in the show notes for part one and for part two a copy at a link to the full court document. I will also be looking to see if I can find a link to the actual transcript from the trial. They say they're going to make that available. I can't wait to read that. We might have another whole episode on that transcript if it comes out. So I once again would like to thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I know these two shows have been kind of long put together, but I think it's very important to actually read from the document and give you the facts about the case. So this has been Matthew Seneff. Thank you for listening to episode 24 of On the Left Podcast. Check out our website at ontheleftpodcast.blogspot.com. Check out my blog site at Liberalize America at liberalizeamerica.blogspot.com. Check us out on Facebook. Put up in your search engine, On the Left Podcast. Go over, read the discussion, join the team. You can drop me an email at ontheleftpodcast@gmail.com. Leave us a review in iTunes. Now, I'm going to be on vacation for a week, so episode 25 will probably not be for another week or so. So I hope you join us then. And for the On the Left team, thanks for listening.
I'm going to go with Lieutenant here, Matthew Senft. Lieutenant Senft, you rock the world.
That's all, folks.